This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. For centuries, the Taj Mahal has dazzled and enchanted. Shah Jahan built the mausoleum in the 17th century as a memorial to his beloved wife, his favorite wife, Mumtaz Mahal. On the program this afternoon, we'll talk with historian Diana Preston about the Taj Mahal and the history of the Mughal Empire. She and her husband, historian Michael Preston, are the authors of Taj Mahal, Passion and Genius at the Heart of the Mughal Empire. They say while the Taj is the empire's ultimate artistic expression, it also represents the beginning of its demise. Listeners, I invite you to join the conversation with a phone call. I look forward to your questions and comments this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Diana and Michael Preston are also the authors of A Pirate of Exquisite Mind, and Diana is the author of four previous books. The new book, Taj Mahal, Passion and Genius at the Heart of the Mughal Empire, is published by Walker & Company. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Diana Preston, welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
How are you?
Oh, very well indeed, thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much for joining us. You've made a number of trips to the Taj Mahal now in northern India. What's it like to try to take in its wonder?
It's difficult to describe unless you've actually sort of been there and seen it. We first started going to India, I guess, over 20 years ago, sort of not long after we got married. And like a lot of people going to India, you know, what is the first thing you go to see? You go to look at the Taj Mahal. And I think also, like a lot of people, we were a little bit worried, you know, would we be disappointed? We're so familiar with that image all over the place that you feel that maybe when you're confronted with the reality of it, it will somehow be a letdown. But it isn't. It is a place of such wondrous, exquisite symmetry. It is so extraordinary to look at that every time I see it, I've been there many times now as I come through the main gateway and I see this great domed marble edifice rising up in front of me at the end of the garden. I can't just help sort of stopping and you know, I can hear my own sharp intake of breath. And I think it has that effect on almost everybody who sees it. You can't quite believe it's real.
Mm. I would like to be there and experience it over a period of time, because in the book you include a photograph of it at sunrise and at sunset, and it must just be beautiful throughout the day in every kind of light.
It is. Again, that's one of the extraordinary things about it. It's a bit like, you know, those sort of serious paintings by Monet of haystacks or of sort of Reims Cathedral. It looks different in different lights. Always beautiful, but it's a very different thing if you see it coming out of the dawn light, just starting to turn a sort of hazy, rosy pink, to how it looks, say, if you go and view it in the moonlight, when certainly, you know, when it's a full moon, it almost turns to silver. It's the most extraordinary thing. It's something to do, I think, with the quality of the materials from which it was constructed, because you know, we're talking, of course, of an edifice which is principally made of white marble studded with gems, and gems, of course, which will catch the sunlight, but equally will flicker in moonlight and starlight.
Mm. Shah Jahan built the Taj as a memorial to his wife, his favorite wife, Mumtaz Mahal. And you say that a central truth of the Taj is that it is the expression of his love for her. It is, you say, also an expression of confident power and opulent majesty. At the time Shah Jahan began to build it, what was the scope of the Mughal Empire?
Well, the Mughal Empire, at this time we're talking of the 17th century, Mumtaz Mahal, the Empress, died in 1631. The empire at that time was vast. It stretched from what we today would call Iran, the borders of Persia in the west. It stretched over in the east through Assam to the borders of Burma. Down in the south, it stretched down in Shah Jahan's time almost to a level with Bombay. So a huge, powerful, rich empire, almost without equal at the time. I suppose, you know, that you could say that the Persian Empire was also a wealthy one. But really, in the 17th century, if you wanted to summarize tremendous, glittering wealth, you would find that, you know, European writers would talk about the court of the great mogul. They would describe jewelry there, you know, rubies the size of duck eggs, treasuries just spilling over with gold and silver and gems. And so the Taj Mahal was really a reflection of this huge power and wealth. It was because of this wealth that Shah Jahan could afford to create something like that out of something so precious as this very fine, shining white marble, and why he could afford to import over 40 types of gems to inset into that marble. You know, he brought jade along the Silk Route from China. He brought lapis lazuli from Afghanistan, turquoises from Tibet, rubies from Sri Lanka. You know, anything you could imagine, any materials that he could get his hands on, he had the power and the wealth to use, and to use to embellish not only this great symbol of love that he'd created with the Taj, but also this great symbol of his majesty, of his might.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see when he comes to power in 1627, 1628, he uses architecture to express his individuality, his reign on the throne.
That's right. I mean, that's one of the features that interested me, particularly when we were researching this book, about not just Shah Jahan, but also some of his forebears. You know, the Mughals were people who come out of Central Asia in the 16th century. They were the descendants of, originally, of Genghis Khan and of Tamerlane, or Timur, as we now call him. They'd come down into India to found themselves as empire. But they brought with them their building traditions from Central Asia. So if you go to places today like Samarkand, and if you look at Timur's tomb and the buildings, other buildings that he built, you can see many of the shapes and forms that came to fruition under Shah Jahan when he built the Taj. But as you say, I mean, Shah Jahan himself, I think, was a passionate architect. We have accounts about him from the Imperial Chronicles, how when he was just, you know, barely more than a boy, he was redesigning his military headquarters in Kabul. He was always interested in building. And of course, when he became emperor with these great funds at his disposal, he had the ability to indulge his tastes, his interests, and to literally try to create, which is I think what he was doing with the Taj, trying to create something which would be a kind of paradise on earth. Mm. He really was trying to create something which was, if you like, faultless.
How careful were the Mughal emperors in chronicling their lives and the events of the empire?
They were very careful, surprisingly careful. I mean, this is a great benefit to historians like ourselves who want to try and understand, you know, how an empire like the Mughal one came into being and what were the motivations, what were the drivers behind their lives. You find, you know, from the time of the very first Mughal emperor, a man called Babur, who was the one who sort of fought the initial battles which established the Mughals in northern India. Babur didn't actually employ court chroniclers, as the later emperors did. He actually wrote his own diary. And you can read that today, and it's as frank and as fresh as if it had been written yesterday. It's written in very direct language, and you have these wonderful descriptions of how to Central Asianize, and people who come from beyond the mountains, these hot plains of India actually looked. You know, Babur, after fighting these battles to establish the Mughals, he looked around himself and he wrote in his diary, oh, well, you know, this place of India, or Hindustan, as they call it, he said, it seems to be a place of few charms, maybe, compared to where I've come from. On the other hand, he said, it does appear to have a great deal of money, which he seemed to think would be important in establishing his empire. But after him, within his successors, you find a very sophisticated court developing. You find scholars flocking to it from across that part of the world, including a lot of well-known scholars from places like Persia. And some of them were employed by the Mughal emperors as poets and as chroniclers. And so you have this wealth of accounts really documenting day to day what the life of the Mughal court was like. And it's a very, very rich account that's been left to us. I think we're very fortunate to have that material.
Yeah. What was that like for you and your husband as historians to work with? On the one hand, it must have been fabulous. On the other hand, it seems that there is so much of it.
There was a great deal of it. We were very fortunate, because at first it seems perhaps a little bit overwhelming. But I think we were fortunate in two ways, that going back really into the 19th century, looking sort of now at the time of the British Raj in India, many of the British officials who were sent to India, they learned the local languages, and they also learned Persian, which was the language in which many of the old Mughal court chronicles had been written. And they produced some very fine translations of the chronicles and of the poetry. And so you have their very lucid renderings into English of all these chronicles. But at the same time, you have to say it's reading those accounts, whatever language you do read them in, it's very different to us, to say, to reading European or American diaries and accounts. The language is very lyrical, it's very flowery. You have to look beneath it to see what is actually being said. You know, very often, if there was an order for somebody to be executed, it wouldn't just say, like, you know, I don't know, one of our kings in England would have said, you know, off with his head. It doesn't say that at all. It says it would be, you know, a good idea if so-and-so's body was lightened of the burden of his rather heavy head. Or something. It's expressed very delicately and very differently. So you have to adapt yourself to that kind of expression. But I think what also helps with it is that because the Mughal Empire was so wealthy, so important, when you get to the 17th century, you also have a lot of European travelers and visitors. They're either emissaries from the European courts, or they're jewel merchants, or they're mercenary soldiers looking for work. They arrive in the Mughal Empire, and they start to describe what they see, how it strikes them. So we have their very differently expressed accounts to put side by side with these very, very elaborate court chronicles. And that, I think, helps create a more rounded picture, perhaps.
Mm. Back to Babur. He is a very interesting character. There are so many interesting characters in this epic. He reigned from 1526 to 1530, and he was a descendant of both Genghis Khan and Timur. I think we're pretty familiar with Genghis Khan, the stories about him, but Timur, not so much. Who was he?
This is Timur, or Tamburlaine, as we sort of know him from the plays of people like Marlowe, because Tamburlaine is actually a sort of corruption of Timur's original name. Timur had a limp, so he was called in his time Timur the Lame. He was a nomad from the Central Asian plains, a marauder, a bit like Genghis Khan, but we're talking now about, you know, over a century and a half after Genghis Khan. And it was Timur who, again, sort of restless to expand his territories, to increase his wealth, he swept down from Asia at the head of a horde of nomads, sort of probing down into India. And he arrived there at the end of the 14th century, and he raided Delhi, the city of Delhi, and he noted its wealth and its artistry. And, again, I found this quite fascinating. Here you have this quite, we think of Timur as a quite brutal, savage warrior. But he arrives in Delhi and he sees some wonderful buildings, some wonderful architecture and craftsmanship. So what does he do? He carries off some of these stonemasons and craftsmen back with him to his own capital of Samarkand, which of course is in what we today know as Uzbekistan. And he used those craftsmen that he sort of purloined from India to start to create some of the tombs and the palaces which are there in Samarkand if you go there today. So Timur, if you like, a warrior, but also showing some of the artistry, the aesthetic sense that was going to come to fruition in some of his descendants, the Mughals, in later centuries in India.
Yeah. It is interesting to think about, on the one hand, these people being great conquerors and being able to, when the occasion arose, the need arose, to lighten someone of the burden of their head, but also the great love they had for literature, for gardens, for architecture.
Very much so. I mean, you're really talking when you sort of get to the moguls of, it's not going too far to call them Renaissance men, if you like. Even, you know, somebody like the first Mughal emperor, Babur, when he swept into somebody else's kingdom and sacked their palaces, one of the first things he did was not sort of to then indulge in wine, women and song, or the sort of the traditional spoils of the conqueror. What he would do is he would say, well, I've conquered this ruler. Now, what did he have in his library? That was the first thing that he wanted to see. He wanted to see the books and the manuscripts. And so it continued. You find that the Mughals built up these wonderful libraries, and these texts were very important to them. I mean, they still, even after arrival in India and establishing themselves, they still lived, although they built their palaces, they still lived a fairly nomadic existence. To keep their empire under control, they had to keep moving around. And the library and the scholars and the poets and the musicians and the dancers and the singers and the painters were the people who traveled with them. They were just as important to the emperors, I think, as the great phalanxes of, you know, marching soldiers and the cavalrymen sort of riding behind them with their standards rippling in the breeze. They really were very intellectual, very aesthetic.
Hmm. Babur's son and Humayun, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
You pronounce it absolutely right.
Okay, and grandson Akbar, they followed and they continued to build the empire. What was most notable about their reigns?
I think what was most notable about their reign was that they were the ones, Akbar in particular, who were able to properly establish the Mughals, because at first, you know, Babur arrived, he fought a battle which enabled him for a while to say that he was the new emperor on the block, if you like, the new ruler of Hindustan. But it didn't last. You know, the local rulers organized themselves, they pushed him out again. Humayun had to struggle to get the throne back. He didn't live, after taking, you know, becoming emperor himself, he did not live very long himself. He was a scholar. It's indicative of the Mughals, you know, how he died. He tripped. He'd been at the top of a tower observing the constellations, and he tripped hurrying down the steps of this tower to go to prayer. But it was his son, Akbar, who, roughly equivalent in time to our great Queen Elizabeth I in England, who really established the Mughal empire. He set up its administrative systems. He pushed its boundaries out. He also did a lot to unify the country, because the Mughals were Muslims, but they had arrived in a country which, although there were some Muslim rulers and some Muslim parts of the country, it was really largely Hindu. And Akbar was very open-minded about religion, and he summoned the representatives of every religion he could find. You know, he invited Christian people to the court, Jewish people, different types of Hindus, Jains. And he encouraged a very liberal, very open debate about religion. He was almost a humanist. I think you could almost say that he, although formally a Muslim, had no perhaps real religion of his own. And I thought this was a very remarkable thing, this interest in religion and this tolerance and this ability to look across and compare and contrast religions. If you think what was going to be going on very shortly in Europe at the time, you know, the Europe of the 17th century, is ripped apart by religious wars. So that to me was perhaps, again, one of the most surprising features of this period of the Mughals.
And the court included both Shia and Sunni Muslims.
Yes, it did. Yeah. Yes, it did. And and at that time, really managing to exist with harmony. That was not to be the case later on. You know, differences and divisions were going to develop as you get into the 17th century. But in Akbar's time, there was this really spirit of intellectual inquiry. He was looking around, wanting to understand the world around him in every sense. I mean, he used marriage as well as a way of overcoming religious differences and of binding his diverse subjects to him. He married, many Hindu princesses, and they were all allowed, you know, whatever the religion of his wives, they were allowed to have, you know, complete religious freedom to follow their own beliefs within the harem.
So then how were the sons, including Shah Jahan's father, raised?
The sons were raised as Sunni Muslims, but it was not, again, at this time, it was it was not as perhaps as we would understand some of the differences to be today. Because again, you know, going back to what I was saying about the intermarriage as a kind of cement to bind the empire together, mm-hmm. if you're looking at the Emperor Shah Jahan, although formerly a Sunni, he was, in terms of his descent, his ancestry, about, you know, three-quarters Hindu. So you had a big mix at the court. And, of course, you know, many of the arrivals at the court coming from other parts of the Muslim world, they were Shias, including the Empress Mumtaz, whom Shah Jahan was going to marry. He was a Sunni, she was a Shia, but there was no problem about that.
Very interesting. Historian Diana Preston is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She and her husband, Michael Preston, are the authors most recently of Taj Mahal, Passion and Genius at the Heart of the Mughal Empire. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Belgium on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd like to come at the Taj Mahal from a slightly different direction. As you pointed out earlier, the building was studded with a great deal of wealth and gems and stuff. And as I remember, didn't the British haul away quite a bit of those gems?
Yes, I was interested in what happened to the, you know, because it seemed to me quite remarkable that the Taj Mahal had managed to exist through all the trauma of, you know, over three centuries. And what happens in the 19th century when the British arrive, you're absolutely right, we have a degree of vandalism going on. There are these accounts I came across of British people going to have picnics in the gardens of the Taj Mahal. And when they got a little bit bored, you know, what would they do? They'd get out a penknife and prize away some of that beautiful jewelled inlay, you know, to send back as a present to Mama in England. But as you move into the 19th century, as things became more organized, you had the Archaeological Survey of India being set up. This is an organization which still exists today and is responsible for the Taj. But this was set up in the mid-19th century and began to protect some of these buildings like the Taj. And it's from that period that you began to have the Taj being protected and then restored. And as you go through the later 19th century, you have the work of people like Lord Curzon, who was viceroy in India, starting to work on restoring the gardens of the Taj, starting to repair the inlay. If you go into the Taj itself, you see there's a beautiful lamp in the central chamber, which was installed in Lord Curzon's time. But ever since the Archaeological Survey of India was set up, from sort of the mid-19th century onwards, the Taj has been protected and progressively restored. And in very recent years, you know, if you go there today, you'll see a great deal of work going on. But picking up, again, you know, you're saying about the British vandalizing the Taj, there were stories about, in the early 19th century, about particular British officials trying to sell off some of the white marble of the Taj and only desisting because they didn't think it was going to fetch a very good price after they shipped it back to England, you know, to auction it off. But some of those stories are really myths. They derive, there was one particular man who tried to sell a white marble bath from another Mughal palace, and that all went wrong, and then he decided he wasn't going to try and ship anything else back to England. But there was never an attempt to try and sort of break up the Taj and ship that off anywhere. But that is a sort of rumor which has sort of persisted down through the centuries.
And if I might point out one other very sad detail, it seems as though the pollution that's essentially next door to the Taj Mahal is dramatically damaging the
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That is a major problem. But, I mean, I think one of the things which is so very encouraging, and when I was there a few months ago, I was absolutely delighted at the progress which has been going on, is that the Indian government has put a cordon around the Taj area, and they've banned certain types of polluting industries from operating too close to the Taj. That's helped. They've also banned petrol-driven, gas-driven vehicles from going close to the Taj. You have to go either in electric vehicles or by horse-drawn cart, or indeed, best of all, probably, you have to walk there. They've restricted the number of visitors even going into the Taj. They've closed it one day a week because it's getting something like 3 million people a year. And this is, I must admit, an aspect I hadn't thought of, but with that volume of people going, even the breath condensing on the marble and on the putty around the gems is doing damage. So they've restricted visitor numbers. But they are now cleaning up the marble. They've found a very traditional techniques. They've even found a sort of a Mughal recipe for it. Was a sort of a Mughal woman's beauty pack she used for her face, but a sort of compound of various materials. But they found that if they put that on the marble, it's very good at drawing some of the polluted yellow out of the marble again. So it's now regaining its original beauty. And there's also, if you go there today, towards the back of the Taj, on the platform on which the Taj itself stands, there's an environmental monitoring station, which shows how seriously the Indian government are taking this. And on any particular day, at any minute of that day, you can get a reading as to what the air quality is around the Taj. So things are being done. I think I'm very encouraged by all of that.
Thank you very much.
Oh,
you're
a pleasure.
Very welcome. Let's talk with another listener now. A caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. I had a professor of history. I took his class one time, and he mentioned something about a dark marble replica, duplicate of the Taj Mahal, which was never built. Could you comment further on that?
Yeah, absolutely. This was an aspect that fascinated us. If you look at some of the 17th century accounts of Europeans who were at the Mughal court, they say quite clearly that Shah Jahan had intended to build himself a black marble version of the Taj Mahal to be his own tomb, and that he was only prevented from doing this by his son, who toppled him from the throne and imprisoned him, and when Shah Jahan died, sort of shoehorned him into the Taj Mahal beside his wife Mumtaz. Now, it's interesting, if you go to the Taj Mahal today and you look at where the Empress is buried, her tomb lies directly beneath the dome. Everything in the Taj is absolutely symmetrical, including her tomb. Her body lies on the central north-south axis of the whole complex. Shah Jahan, her husband, has definitely just been, if you like, sort of pushed in to one side. It's the only asymmetrical thing, really, in the whole complex. It was absolutely clear to us that Shah Jahan had never intended to be buried there, and that he could, you know, he probably almost definitely had intended to have his own tomb. And we think that the place he was going to build it was probably directly across the Jamuna River from the Taj Mahal in a garden that's been newly excavated. The Smithsonian have been working there together with the Archaeological Survey of India. This is a newly discovered, currently being restored garden called the Mata Bagh, or Moonlight Garden, which was built as part of the Taj complex. And Shah Jahan used to walk there at night amid the night flowering plants and shrubs that were put there, so he could admire the reflection of the Taj across the river when the moon was high. So we think that's probably where he had intended to build a tomb for himself, so he was prevented from doing that. Now, of course, the very interesting question you raise, had he intended to build it in black marble? We could find no concrete proof that he had definitely meant to do that, but a lot of circumstantial evidence, if you like. We found that he did like to work in black marble. If you go to Kashmir, in the far northwest of India, the gardens he built, the Shalimar Gardens, there is a black marble pavilion, beautiful black marble pavilion that he built. And also in the Taj itself, there's, you know, black marble is used around the white marble blocks. It's used in the tessellated white marble platform that the Taj stands in. There would have been a logic to a counterpointing Taj in black marble. So, you know, the conclusion we come to in the book is that it would not have been beyond him to have wanted to build himself a black marble Taj.
Oh, that's fascinating. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Other questions are invited for our guest historian, Diana Preston, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Diana and Michael Preston, the authors most recently of Taj Mahal, Passion and Genius at the Heart of the Mughal Empire. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Just to give folks a little background here, it might be helpful just very quickly to mention a few dates to give us some perspective here. Shah Jahan was born in 1592. He reigned from 1627 to 1658. He died in 1666 at the age of 70. Diana, there were, to put it To put it mildly, there were plenty of jealousies and intrigues in the Mughal Empire. At the close of your prologue, you tell readers that the story that is about to unfold in the coming pages is in part about powerful, charismatic women dominating court politics from behind the silken screens of the harem. This is certainly the case of a woman by the name of Nur Jahan. Tell us about her, and then maybe you would tell us a bit about the role of women in the imperial court.
Yes, I was very intrigued by this question of the women of the imperial harem, because until I started the research, I had this image of, you know, these sort of no doubt beautiful creatures, but shut away from the world, not really intervening in politics or business, commerce, anything like that. And this was not really the case at all. And you just mentioned a lady called Nur. She was from the same Persian family as the empress for whom the Taj Mahal was built. In fact, she was the empress's aunt. And what happened was that she, as the wife of a courtier, caught the eye of Shah Jahan's father, the Emperor Jehangir, when she was a widow in her 30s. Now, he married Nur, and he, like a lot of the Mughal emperors before him, as he got older, he had become addicted to both to wine, to opium. He was starting to lose his grip a little bit on governing. But Nur was, you know, very able to compensate for that. She really became the de facto ruler for a while of the Mughal Empire, you know, probably after the emperor, certainly the most powerful person in the kingdom. She even signed decrees under her own name. She had the power of life and death over people. Such was her power that Shah Jahan, you know, who was at first as a young man her ally, when Nur became even more powerful, he eventually got worried about this because he thought, well, I'm one of the sons of the emperor. You know, I am worried about my chances of succeeding to the throne. And he was right to be concerned because Nur by then was actually plotting to put her daughter by her first marriage onto the throne. So you have Shah Jahan rebelling against her, fleeing with his wife Mumtaz. And they were literally hunted like foxes by Nur and her armies, you know, across India and back again, in danger of their lives. You know, so such was the power of this woman, Nur. Now, they were eventually reconciled with Nur and with the Emperor Jehangir on the basis that they promised sort of to stay away from the court. But it was really because of Nur that, you know, there was this rift at the time in the family that Shah Jahan was in revolt against his father. His life was at risk. But it was a very good illustration that, you know, women could exercise, you know, in that country at that time, real power and influence. And it wasn't just at a political level. You know, I found evidence of other women in the harem really being very successful and accomplished businesswomen, like Nur herself. They would buy up cargoes of all kinds of things which the West were interested in, silks and the beautiful cottons and indigo. And spices, lots of things that the West was hungry for. And using sort of male members of their families as intermediaries, they would buy fleets of merchant ships and they would trade all over the world. So they amassed great wealth. But I was interested as well, you know, after the death of Nur and the death of Jehangir, when the Emperor Shah Jahan and his wife Mumtaz eventually come to the throne for their all-too-brief reign, that Mumtaz herself was given power by Shah Jahan. You know, we have evidence that, you know, she had her own seal with which to stamp imperial documents. We also know that Shah Jahan would send into the harem important imperial decrees for her to peruse to make sure that she was happy with them before they were issued, before they became law. So these women were not just sort of sitting in the background. They were very real influences on the lives of their husband and on the politics of their country.
And their sexual pleasure was important.
Very much so. I mean, this, again, you know, we've talked about the artistry and we've talked a bit about the politics, but this was also a very sensual place. You know, the Mughal court was a place where the arts of love were very well understood. There were all kinds of sophisticated guides to lovemaking, all kinds of aphrodisiacs which were used. The clothing, the luscious clothing of the women of the imperial harem, is beautifully captured in some of the chronicles. These brilliantly colored, very sheer silks, the wonderful jewels that these women had to enhance their beauty. You know, we have the account of a European doctor who, quite unusually, was one day allowed into the harem to treat one of the women who had fallen ill. And he complained that it was very difficult. He couldn't really find her pulse because she had these ropes and ropes of pearls wound around her arms. So if you like, you know, this was a court where everything was done to enhance the physical beauty of the women there. Everything was done to cater for the emperor's pleasure. Now, Shah Jahan, in the context of the Mughal emperors, was unusual in the fact that really from, although he did have two other wives, really marriages which were made purely for political reasons, from the time he married Mumtaz Mahal, he was really a one-woman man. Their love, their friendship, their passion, their affinity is very well documented in the chronicles. But, you know, many of the other emperors had these huge harems. You're talking about hundreds of women in the harem. There could be a different woman every night. And this was all documented. It was all noted in the chronicles, who the emperor had summoned each night. All the births and deaths of all the children were meticulously recorded. The harem, you know, for many of the Mughal emperors, was really a sort of a pleasure ground, if you like. And it had another function which interests me beyond sort of the one of sensuality. It was also a little bit like, you could say, almost like going back to the womb for the emperor. The emperor was the only male allowed to sleep there at night. There were, of course, eunuchs guarding the harem. But he was the only male allowed to pass the night there. So it was somewhere where he would feel safe amongst his women, surrounded by all his guards, no other men around. It was the one place which perhaps, you know, a Mughal emperor could feel entirely safe from assassination attempts.
Mm. And also, given the power that these women had, it would be a place where, perhaps I'm not right on this, but, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, the role of non-Muslim wives and how that cemented relations with various areas of the empire. So there was, it was not only a place of safety and pleasure, but also of maybe politics as well.
I'm sure that it was a place of politics. We know that, of course, you know, the Mughal women of the harem, they were not allowed to attend the daily audiences and assemblies that were held in the palaces, you know, when the emperor would sit on his glittering throne with his princes around him and all his courtiers and his subjects and hear petitions and that sort of thing. But if you go to some of those palaces today and you see where the throne would have been, if you look behind them, you can see very ornately carved marble grills. And these are the grills behind which the women could sit and listen and observe. They could sit there, they could know everything that was going on. They couldn't be seen themselves, but it meant that they could always be in touch with what was happening. And then, of course, you know, for the midday meal or the evening meal, where did the emperor go? He went back into the harem where he would discuss with the women of his family the proceedings for that day. So, yes, you know, they were very well informed about what was going on. And they could also, of course, exercise influence not only through their husbands but through their brothers, their nephews. You know, we're talking of big family clans with sort of tentacles stretching far out. So they had many ways, really, to make their own views and ideas felt.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line 2. Hi.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually kind of interested in hearing you speak about the connections between religion and the building styles that were going on, especially in consideration of the way that Akbar, you know, Shah Jahan's grandfather, was creating a new religion in some respects as he was creating a new identity in the empire, and then how that was replicated in his use of, say, traditional both Hindu and other elements from Persian, the Islamic world, in the construction of his various temples. And I'll listen. Thank you.
That's a great question.
Yes, certainly. I mean, Akbar is particularly fascinating from that point of view, because if you look at what he created, and, you know, like some of the other Mughals, he too was a great builder. If you go to the city of Agra, where the Taj is, and then you journey just a few miles beyond that into really what is desert terrain, you come to a wonderful, now abandoned, red sandstone city called Fatehpur Sikri, which was created by Akbar. And it's really, it's so heavily influenced by the Hindu style. He borrowed from the Hindu techniques, the Hindu craftsmen. They could carve sandstone as intricately as if it was wood. And so in the city of Fatehpur Sikri, for his Hindu wives, Akbar created these marvelous sort of multi-tiered carved palaces. And because of the very dry desert conditions, that has really not, those buildings haven't suffered through the intervening centuries. And if you go there, you get a very good illustration of the kind of sort of the fusion of architectural styles that was a consequence of this religious fusion that we have under Akbar.
Very good. Thank you for the call. Let's go back and talk about Mumtaz Mahal herself. What was she like? What did she look like? Tell us about her.
Yes, it's a very good question. What did she look like? And this has tantalized me so much. There are two paintings, one of which is a 19th century copy of an earlier painting, which some people believe to be Mumtaz, but I think the majority of historians would probably argue against that, which only leaves us with one portrait, which is probably, not definitely, but again, just probably Mumtaz, perhaps another 90% likely to be Mumtaz. And it shows us a slender, dark-eyed woman, very long, graceful eyes, closely resembling, actually, the many portraits which have come down to us of her aunt. We were talking about the powerful Empress Nur. I think these two women did look very alike. They were Persians. Mumtaz's grandfather had come to the Mughal court from Persia. So we're talking of, if you think of other Persian miniatures, I think that's how you would visualize Mumtaz. We know from the accounts that she was extraordinarily beautiful. Anybody who was lucky enough to see her, and there were occasions where the women of the court were allowed to appear unveiled at various festivities. Anybody who saw her remarked on her quite extraordinary beauty. We know that Shah Jahan saw her and fell in love with her when they were both really just teenagers. There was one particular festival in the palace at Agra when he did see her unveiled. He fell in love with her. He wanted to marry her. He was allowed to become betrothed to her. But then something went wrong. Her family fell from favor. One of her brothers was executed for treason. She had to wait 7 years before being allowed to marry Shah Jahan. And in the interim, she had to see him contracting a dynastic marriage to a foreign princess. So her beauty, if you like, which had brought her to the attention of Shah Jahan, then brought her, in her early life, I think, some years of uncertainty and unhappiness. But, of course, that ended when, they were eventually allowed to marry. And from that time, they were very seldom apart.
Mm. 14 pregnancies.
Mm. I know, that again interested me because I felt in so much of what I'd sort of previously read about the Taj or been told when I'd gone there that, everybody says, oh, yes, the Taj Mahal built as a monument to love for a dead empress who had 14 children. But I had never been able to find out anywhere just what her life, might have been like. Mm-hmm. Married for 19 years, giving birth to 14 children. And that's, as I went back through the chronicles, trying to plot the key events of her life against what was going on in terms of sort of the politics of the court, I was able to sort of build a picture of a life which was not one of just of ease and luxury and, lying on silken cushions in the harem. A lot of that time she was on the move with Shah Jahan. He was, for a long part of their marriage, he was really not yet on the throne. He was a warrior prince fighting his father's campaigns. So she was accompanying him on campaign, on the march across India. So imagine that with all those pregnancies. Then later in their marriage, when he rebelled against his father and they were fugitives, again, she was having to cope with multiple births and deaths of some of her children. When I plotted, what was happening in her life, it was really traumatic. It was very moving. You'd find in the space, in one period of her life, in about 14 months, you'd have one child dying. 2 months later, she'd give birth to another. And then while she was just recovering from that, another child would fall in and die. So, of the 14 children that she gave birth to, only 7, in fact, survived into adulthood. Mm. A very traumatic life for her in many ways.
Yeah. It's a wonderful story. Thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon and our listeners.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Celeste.
Diana Preston has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. She and her husband, Michael Preston, are historians. Their latest book, Taj Mahal, Passion and Genius at the Heart of the Mughal Empire. The book is published by Walker & Company.